One. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Out with your hosts, Luke Tim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, wage slaves, once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet, with your host, Charnchi, also known as Chomskin, and Mr. 1001 Nights. And hopefully we'll get Buttigieg as well to call. He's going to probably be calling later on in the show. And we got a lot of items to talk about, and
How you doing, Jonathan?
Oh, I'm kind of messed up, but I guess surviving.
I wish I was a wage slave.
Right. We don't even have jobs. We don't even rise to the level of wage slavery anymore. We're getting by.
Yeah, we're the throwaway people, remember?
That's right. We're dumpster divers. Well, not quite, not yet, but yeah, it's funny because here in San Francisco, for example, if you go to some of the poorer neighborhoods, like the Tenderloin, something called the Tenderloin, you're seeing very, very long lines of people waiting to get food, more and more poor people. And, it's like people are grateful to be wage slaves, grateful to have a job. And that's why I always remind my listeners that full employment is a big threat for the employer class. They don't even want to have a full employed, army of wage slaves, because that gives them too much bargaining power. If you are fully employed, if you have a fully employed workforce, you can't replace them, because they're already, there's already no more places to fill in. So they can ask for higher wages, ask for better conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So this is working just great for the business class, and but I guess the big news. I guess perhaps before we get into the news, since we're getting toward the end of the week, we should thank our listeners, because we're getting more and more listeners. I want to remind that you guys can call in anytime you want, although we usually prefer you to call in the second half of the show. But you can call in, and the guest call-in number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. And if I'm not mistaken, we're actually having a pretty remarkable guest tomorrow. That's going to be Paul Street, who's written some remarkable pieces for ZNet and other magazines. This guy knows Obama inside out. He's a very sharp thinker. So
He started. He was based in Chicago when Obama just started his rise, and he kind of followed him throughout. And he kind of, not in a boasting way, but he kind of said in his book that he predicted his presidency, basically, like back in Chicago days, basically when he gave the talk at the National Convention, the Democratic Convention, I think. He knew that the business sector is going to love this guy, because he has all the he has the right skin color and, something hip, but he has all the right connections,
Right, and
right, corporate values.
I think Obama has been very good at exploiting his skin color, and, of course, some of the big news we've heard about in the sycophantic, corporate media was his Nobel Peace Prize speech. And one of the things he claimed was that he stood where he was as a result of the moral force of people like Martin Luther King. And of course, the answer of someone like me, or anybody with their head on their shoulders, is that no, Mr. Obama, as I proved in my documentary Golden Rule, the investment theory of politics, you were put into power by the financial sector of American capitalism. And unfortunately, Martin Luther King's honorable work did not alter the fundamental institutional structure of our society. And therefore, all Obama can claim to have a relation, you know, with him is skin color, you know, a mere veneer in his case. So it's not, you know, it's not something that should be overlooked, but it is something that he has brilliantly used in his PR campaign to make himself look as a man of the people, as someone who's fighting for grassroots activism. No, he's not. He's a member of the elite. He's doing their bidding, and you couldn't really expect anything other than that, given the power structure we have in place. And that's something that hopefully Paul Street will describe in detail tomorrow.
Right, right. And I don't know if you saw the speech, right? I read the speech in the New York Times, I think. And the first, I mean, it really takes balls to quote Martin Luther King, you know, like, while you're sending troops, whatever. But, like, he quotes him and Gandhi at the same time, you know, talking about nonviolence and all this stuff. And in the very next paragraph, he's trying to justify, you know, he's saying, well, when you're a head of state, sometimes you have to use the military to maintain peace. I was just like...
Right, I mean,
you got some balls saying that.
It's like saying, look, I hate, you know, I think being a vegan is great. I hate animal cruelty, but I'm the CEO of McDonald's. You know, that's basically the so it's an exercise in doublethink, and as we all know, even the devil can quote the devil, you know, for his own purposes, and that's what he's done. And, you know, all the assumptions in his speech were wrong. The like he was talking about, you know, the first thing he said about war was that the, you know, it would be hard to eradicate violent conflict. But of course, then that was a hard truth. He said, well, the problem is that power systems like the U.S. government do not try to eradicate violent conflict. They are the main perpetrators and instigators of violent conflict. And that's a problem, that once we have a set of assumptions that are totally flawed, then we can proceed with all sorts of different statements that have no relation to reality. And that's what his speech was all about. I didn't listen to the whole thing, and, you know, but it's just...
He repeatedly cited just war, you know, doctrines, and, you know, calling this and that just war, and... It's kind of funny that this notion had come back. I mean, it was a, I think it was a Christian concept of just war from the Middle Ages, and it's come back. Actually, I asked Howard Zinn about this, and he told me people like Walzer, who's a main proponent, and you know, Gene Elkstein or something. They wrote these books to try to justify Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
I know Michael Walzer.
Michael Walzer is a big guy in Princeton.
Yeah, he's a joke. I mean, you know, he wrote a book basically. The message of the book was, if we carry out aggression, that's just. If they do it, it's evil. They're evildoers. Right. And it's all based on the same sort of mechanisms of rationalization that I was talking about. You basically construct an alternate version of reality where all the same facts and actions that would make the official enemy look like a monster. When you do those same actions, you're an angel. That's basically, and you can talk about the specifics of the Afghanistan war. I mean, throughout all these years of anti-war activism, when the Bush administration was in power. We repeatedly were talking about Iraq, how it was illegal, how it was for oil, how the U.S. had supported Saddam through his worst atrocities, how it wasn't for democracy because the U.S. supports dozens of dictatorships, etc., etc. But everybody sort of went along with the Afghanistan war because the assumption was that this was actually a legal war, it was the good war. I mean, that's how they called it in the media. But as we've repeated over and over again in this program, no, it wasn't a legal war. And you know, some of the things that Paul Street will explain is that indeed the war was not approved by the Security Council. The war against Afghanistan, in fact, was because the Taliban refused to hand over suspects without evidence. You know, the 8 months after the invasion of Afghanistan, Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, he was asked by the Washington Post, and what he said was they thought that perhaps the plot was concocted in Afghanistan but implemented from Germany and the United Arab Emirates. So they didn't know even 8 months later. So obviously they didn't know when the invasion was carried out. So it was totally illegal. And furthermore, as the New York Times reported, it put over a million Afghans, a further million Afghans, under the threat of starvation because of all the food aid agencies having to withdraw from the country due to the bombing. So all these factors made the war not only illegal in violation of Article 51 of the UN Charter and, of course, the U.S. Constitution, because the United States is a party to the UN Charter, and the U.S. Constitution says that any treaty the U.S. is a party to is the supreme law of the land. So not only was it an illegal act, but it was an extremely immoral act, putting hundreds of thousands of people under threat of starvation. And, you know, the that's, you know, quite apart from the historical background of you know, U.S. support for the Mujahideen and Bin Laden to fight against the Soviets, in the words of Brzezinski, who was Carter's security advisor, to lure the Russians into Afghanistan to give them their Vietnam. So we have a historical and amnesia about what's happened. And given that these facts are not out in the open, so we can proceed with all kinds of garbage about, oh, look how great we are. And, you know, of course, Obama spoke about, you know, for 60 years we've preserved the global peace. I mean, just ridiculous. The U.S. has supported dozens of dictators, you know, Suharto, Duvalier, Marcos, Ceausescu, Mobutu, the Shah, Pinochet, Batista, Diem in South Vietnam. I mean, all over. And, of course, you know, the biggest dictatorship in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, you know, supported by the U.S., Obama, of course, bowing to the king there. Look, the whole thing is a joke. The U.S. government does what you would expect from any power structure, which is to pursue its own interest and to destroy any obstacles to domination. And in our case, since we live in a capitalist world system, that means corporations dominating economies and exploiting workers. And so that's a reality that should have been out in the open.
Yeah, nothing in the speech was particularly surprising. And I don't know. I mean, I expected the same, you know, like they hit on all the elite speaking points, you know. But some people are still, you know, feeling, oh, we're betrayed. And
well, you know what it is? What really sort of irritated me is that, you know, I myself spent a lot of years in Europe growing up in Spain, and also I lived in Germany, and Europeans have this concept, this delusional concept, oh, we are different from the United States because, you know, we somehow are not, we don't live in elite systems, we don't, I mean, it's just ludicrous. All these European snobs attending this conference, this Nobel Peace Prize conference, they loved Obama. You know, he's a you know, soft-spoken. I mean, he's smart. He talks very smooth words and so on. And they love that. And so they fall for all that crap. And that's because they're not fundamentally different. These countries,
right? I mean, they share the same values. You know, the European elites share the same values as people here, and same thing with the fellow elites. You know?
Yeah. They just don't have the military power, and they have a deal where the United States plays a certain function. But let's not forget about that. I mean, let's not forget that fundamental state capitalist structure of all these countries is similar. So you would expect the same ideology or the same sort of similar type of paradigm, ideological paradigm, coming out of these power structures, and you know. that's where, as radicals, we always have to be pointing at not only the facts of the matter, but the institutional prerogatives, the institutional imperatives that drive our system. So
yeah, that's what I always talk about. But, you know, the thing that really stood out to me was that quoting MLK in one sentence and then the next sentence radically, you know, go against the whole notion. So it took balls to do that, you know.
Another thing that sort of stood out that he said, well, you know, very often war is needed to preserve peace, you know, so therefore our war is justified. So, I mean, even ignoring, you know, all the facts that I mentioned about the illegality of the wars the U.S. has engaged in, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Iraq, et cetera, you know, what he was in effect saying is that dozens of other countries would have the right to bomb and invade the United States. And then the leaders of those countries bombing and invading the United States, they would have the right to go to get the Nobel Peace Prize and say this exact same thing he said with actually more justification, saying, well, look, we have to invade and bomb the United States because, you know, there's evil in the world. And, you know, it's but the fact that people don't see this, that dozens of countries under Obama's own standards, in fact, less stringent standard. I mean, more stringent standard. Sorry, because you know, in fact, a lot of countries the U.S. has attacked would qualify under Article 51 of the UN Charter to bomb the United States. They would.
Right.
Yet, if these countries did a fraction of what we do without having the backing of the Security Council, without having the backing of Article 51, if they did a fraction with much more justification, we would consider it an outrage. And yet, you know, like I said, these countries could be bombing the United States, invading the United States, and then receiving the praises of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. That's a big joke. The whole thing is a big joke. So anyway, so I guess we could go on and talk about some news here. And I guess the first thing would be, hey, Obama continues the Bush-era rejection of biological weapons inspections. Ooh, what a surprise. So it says the White House has announced it will continue a Bush administration policy of rejecting a global inspection system for biological weapons. On Wednesday, the Obama administration said the U.S. remains opposed to inserting a new verification protocol in the Biological Weapons Convention. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control Ellen Tauscher made the announcement at a meeting of the convention's signatories in Geneva. So there you have it. You know, another sign of what's really happening here. So
yeah. we're the hegemon, man. We could do anything we want.
Right, and all the moral standards.
Don't you know that?
Shift. That's I think what the facts
show.
Yeah,
just get over it. Get over it.
And we actually asked David to call in, so I'm wondering if you could send him a little message and tell him to call.
Maybe he might not be around, you know.
He might not be around.
Maybe Joey.
Yeah, any of you guys.
Joey's just around.
Just call in. We need voices and choices here. And another interesting statement coming from the U.S., the U.S. representative, the U.S. negotiator at Copenhagen, says U.S. categorically rejects climate reparations. Says in Copenhagen, the U.S. has rejected calls for the payment of climate reparations to poorer countries for the devastation wrought by brought by global warming. Reparations advocates says the United States and other industrialized nations owe a debt to poorer countries for the effects of decades of emissions. On Wednesday, the lead U.S. negotiator, Todd Stern, said he categorically rejects the principle of climate debt. Quote, "We absolutely recognize our historic role in putting the emissions in the atmosphere up there that are there now, but the sense of guilt or culpability of reparations, I just categorically reject that." So, I mean, that's what you'd expect from power systems, just utter and total lack of accountability, which is, in fact, a feature of psychopathy. Do you remember, Chanchi, that documentary called The Corporation, where at
Ashcar, whatever.
At one point, they interview Robert Hare, who's a specialist in psychopathy, and he talks about the features that define psychopaths and how they could apply to corporations. And this particular feature, not admitting, you know, actually, I have to say this is a little bit different because the fact that they recognize their historic role in having emissions and putting out emissions into the atmosphere, that is probably, I mean, it's very hard to deny. But the factor, I think, that coincides with this corporate psychopathy is that they have no sense of guilt or culpability. So I think that is that fits like white on rice with the model of these corporations being psychopathic, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are a legal person, so I guess, you know, it's kind of fun to tag them with the title, but, you know, institutions are basically amoral, right? I mean, they're not moral agents, really. But, you know, they have legal personhood in this country, and I guess every country, right?
Yeah,
totally unjustifiable.
What, you know, there's something, you know, I think we all have sort of like our weak spots or just areas where we get really irritated by certain things that happen in our lives. And the one thing that really irritates me is this intellectual climate around centers of power. I mean, it really irritates the hell out of me to hear people lying like that and being skilled liars. I mean, what really angers me is they're very good liars and they're so good at twisting the facts to serve the elite. And
but I mean that's their role, you know. That's the role of most of, you know, intelligentsia, right? To lie in service of power. And it's very rare to get intellectuals that tell the truth, you know. That's why we, you know, enjoy Chomsky and Howard Zinn, people like that. You know, they need to be treasured. But
right, and they're getting old, so we have pretty big boots to fill in.
We gotta step up. Really.
Right. So that's something that we always have to have in mind, that these people are not going to be here forever. So, yeah, and another another fact that I think would have been good to mention in my documentary. I keep plugging it in, but since it's so close to it's always on my mind, is the money in politics. There's a new item here that says Democrats' rejection of public option, the healthcare public option, boosts insurers' stocks. Back in the United States, stock prices in the nation's largest insurance companies are on the rise following news of a Senate plan to abandon the public insurance option. The Standard & Poor's Managed Healthcare Index rose 1.6% Wednesday compared to a 0.6% drop for the broader index of 500 companies. The gains followed Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's announcement that Democrats will not propose a government-funded health plan to compete with private insurers. Instead, Democrats will back a measure in which the Federal Office of Personnel Management, would hire the insurance companies to run government-backed health plans. So, and of course, this is one day after Reid's announcement. A new poll showed a majority of Americans continue to support the public option rejected by Democrats. So, I mean, there you have it. I mean, it's as clear as can be that there's a very direct relationship between government and the stock market, and the one relation that I pointed out, which I wish was more even more significant than this, was the one that was pointed out by Thomas Ferguson when he said that you know, the when a certain candidate is going to be elected, that stocks go up or down, you know, of course in relation to contributions of corporations to their campaign. So the more contributions you know, there are to certain campaigns that affects the stock market, because they understand, the businesses understand, you know, where the economy is going to sort of, in which direction it's going to go. And in fact, congressmen and senators make huge amounts of money. They make record amounts in their portfolios because they know, they have inside knowledge about this whole process. So the whole thing is a big scam. It's unbelievable. So anyway, folks,
Yeah, well, I
go
have a
ahead.
question for you,
Yep.
actually, on that. Well, the libertarian right always reverse the relationship. Like we see private wealth as the background that's driving state power, right?
Yeah.
But they always like to reverse the relationship, and I was wondering if you really know why there's a disconnect there.
Well, I think the disconnect has to do with the fact that they didn't really listen to they didn't their reading of history is incorrect, I think, and they didn't really read classic economists like Adam Smith. I mean, Adam Smith said that unions, capitalist unions, that is capitalists getting together to work on their common interest, that is older. And you know, usually more easy to pursue than workers' unions, because you know, there's fewer capitalists than workers, so therefore they have a greater ability to get together and join their forces. And that's as old as history. Adam Smith mentioned it, and it's just natural that people who have common interests will join. So, for example, in the United States right now, we have about 8,000 chambers of commerce. Now, why do we have 8,000 chambers of commerce, which are basically unions instead of workers? They're unions of businesses. You know, these business unions, they get together and they push for legislation that will satisfy their interest. So, if they, what they have to understand, these free marketeers, is that businesses have common interest, and there usually are blocks of businesses that have distinct common interests, and some businesses are more free market, that is, they're less in favor of, for example, protectionism, and they want to be able to export without tariffs and stuff like that, and import stuff without tariffs. And you have other industries that are less in favor of free trade. For example, in the United States, at the beginning, after the after the Civil War, the industrialists in the North pushed the government to of the United States to erect very tough protectionist barriers against British and European goods that would compete with what Alexander Hamilton called infant industry. They were trying to build up their industry. And in order to build up your industry, you got to protect yourself against foreign competitors. And because, I mean, otherwise, if that hadn't happened, the United St if the United States had pursued its comparative advantage, which is the a formula prescribed by free marketeers, we wouldn't have an industry right now. We would be exporting fish and fur, which were the sort of natural resources the U.S. had. So you need protectionism. And once again, so that's one measure by which blocks of investors differ from each other. Another one is labor intensity. So in the 19th century, we know that almost all industries were very labor intensive. That is, they employed a lot of workers. With the shift from coal to oil in the 20th century, you had a lot of industries that had fewer workers. And that meant that was another factor that allowed these industries to develop a different political identity, because if you have fewer workers, you can come to a compromise with the government that is struggling against labor for, say, lower wage, I mean, sorry, a little bit higher wages, or some, unions, because if you have fewer workers, it doesn't hurt you as much to, compromise with a sort of weak labor movement. So, in other words, yeah, I'm like you say, I'm getting ranty. I'm talking a little bit too much, but yeah, I mean, the thing is that it's, we have to understand that these blocks of investors drive the system, and that it's not about personalities or any other factors. Is that what you would? Do you think that answers the question of the free marketeers?
Well, I mean, you make a good point. You started describing the investment theory a little bit, but I was kind of looking at it from how it relates to the mood of anti-politics and with this populist right wing. And you can see, like, the culturally, the two groups don't really match up, but then they're able to tap into that the mood of anti-politics, which is kind of pretty powerful here. What do you think about that? You know, the right libertarians tapping into the populism.
Right, and I describe
the
that.
Dunk-putting, you know.
Let me also mention one thing about common interest, and that is that, let's say that people have a common interest, workers have a common interest. That does not automatically mean that they need to have a state, okay? This is an answer to free marketeers. Why? Because workers can organize themselves in a non-hierarchical fashion, okay? So you could have workers' councils, consumer councils, regional federations, and like, you know, the Spanish anarchists, and you don't need a centralized state to, you know, manage the whole thing. You can have federations, you can have horizontal representation, horizontal representation rather than vertical, right? And but in contrast, if businesses have common interest, they have to have a state because for a simple reason, they themselves are hierarchical. They themselves follow a structure that is hierarchical and not democratic. That is, if you look at the structure of a business, it has the owner, and then you have the wage laborers who have to rent themselves to the owner. So you have this structure that is not democratic, that is hierarchical. So it just makes sense that the overarching structure that would regulate their common interests is also going to be hierarchical. So that means that it's going to be a state. It's going to be a government. Okay, so that's precisely the reason why free marketeers should not have delusions about the relationship between capitalism and the state. It's a very close historical relationship, and for a very good reason. And yeah, so and as far as the mood of anti-politics, I think it's just a propaganda strategy to steer people away from government policies that benefit people and support government policies that benefit big business. That's what really that's all about, I think. So anyway, should we go into break?
Cool.
I think I'm ranting way too much here, Charnshi. If you wanna talk, I guess you're staying a little quiet there. So apologize for that. So do you want to play any song in particular?
No, you take a pick. Anything
all right.
On the switchboard.
So let's play a little bit Bob Marley, Slave Driver. All right, we'll be back in a few minutes with the Authority Smashing Hour. Okay.
Out in the Latin Barrasol,
Bob Marley, Slave Driver. Welcome back to the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet. And I remind listeners, you can call in. The number is 646-716-8106. We'll post the number in the chat room, or Charnchi will. And once again, 646-716-8106. So what's going on with this link you sent me about a green book? Charging?
Yes, Zeno asked a question about what did you think about these books, The Coming Insurrection and the Green Book? I haven't read the second one. The first one I got through like a page and kind of, I don't know, incoherent garbage.
Well, I don't know. I read a little bit of The Coming Insurrection. It seemed to me that, you know, the language was just not the kind of language that I enjoy reading. So, but I read a review of it, and it was basically the reviewer, whether he was right or wrong, said that The Coming Insurrection was a reflection of desperation, sort of like the lack of labor organization, sort of like, you know, leading people to take these sort of, you know, desperate tactics. So that, you know, we should focus more on building a labor movement and stuff. So that seemed reasonable, although I haven't read the actual manuscript, so I couldn't tell you. As for this green book, I'm reading this Wikipedia article here, and it looks like a little bit like, you know, Lenin's... what is it, State and Revolution or whatever, where he, you know, praised workers' councils and all those things, and it was sort of pretty libertarian socialist. But, you know, it's easy to write something nice, and then, you know, while you're on the throne of of state power, you know, and that's what happened. You know, Lenin gained state power, and look what happened, you know. So with Gaddafi, I'm sure it's the same. You know, Gaddafi can say all he wants about participatory democracy, but, you know, the guy's a dictator, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, maybe he has some good ideas, and, you know, maybe we ought to read the book, you know, maybe there's some valuable stuff there to learn, but, you know, what we should always understand is that, you know, it's more about the structures that are in place rather than the ideas. I mean, the ideas are good if they're backed by actions. And obviously, in the case of Gaddafi, that's not the case. What's your take on that?
Since I haven't read much of the books, I can't say.
Right. I mean,
I'll be referring from Kant.
Someone is saying here in the chat room that the Green Book sounds like a bit like Paracon. So, you know, I have to say that some of these, you know, you know, some of these dictators who you know are at the top of the so-called socialist states, they write pretty good stuff. I mean, I enjoy reading Fidel Castro sometimes. You know, he actually, you know, he's a pretty sharp thinker in many ways, and I enjoy reading some of his stuff. You know, so, and in fact, I mean, some of the things he talks about, you know, have to do with, for example, in the case of Fidel Castro, he spoke about how they managed to survive the embargo, and especially after the fall of the Iron Curtain, the Soviet Union stopped shipping all these goodies to Cuba, so they had to become very self-reliant, and they had to learn all these methods of growing, you know, crops and stuff like that. You know, the biological, so-called biological war, where you use some insects to get rid of plagues and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, talks about stuff like that, which is interesting. But, you know, let's face it. I mean, participatory democracy, real libertarian socialism, is based on, you know, power from below. And once you have, you know, such extreme state power, It's very hard to call that anything like socialism. You can call it that. You can call anything you want. You know, it doesn't mean it's true. So,
hey,
if anybody,
Jonathan.
Yep.
Yeah. Speaking of Par Econ, I wonder. You know how some anarchists really don't like it. You know, they've been like a lot of quote unquote critiques about it, but not really delve into some of the institutions mm-hmm. that Par Econ talk about. Why do you think that is? I personally think it's very compatible with a lot of anarchist strands, but why do you think such a rejection?
Well, I can only guess. I think it's twofold, at least from my own, you know, sort of subjective perception here. One, people just love to criticize stuff, you know, just this love to criticize other people and, you know, become sectarian and so on. So that's one reason. And the other reason is that perhaps they, you know, they think it's too formulaic. I mean, Barry Pateman, when I interviewed him back in the Anarchist Book Fair in 2007, he thought it was too, I forget what the word he used was, but
stultifying.
Stultifying, that it was too, but, you know, the thing is that maybe it gives you some ideas, and I think some of those are valid. And then, you know, depending on your situation, depending on, you can change things. But you know, I think a lot of it makes sense, and I like it. You know, I like a lot of the stuff there. I don't know if all of it could work out the way he says it would. The part where I think it starts getting a little more complicated is when he talks about allocation of goods. Okay, so you know, the I mean, we all agree on having a say in proportion to the degree we're affected. You know, maybe getting paid according to effort and sacrifice. Some people prefer according to need, but that of course would be, you know, farther in the future, more toward a libertarian communist system.
I think he does address need. I mean,
The
participatory planning stage, you can address need, and then the rest of it, you know, effort and sacrifice. But I think the main problem is that, you know, the planning mechanism that he proposed just doesn't exist. You can't replicate it in a small publishing house, let's say, you know. You have to do it over like a larger pool of different industries and that stuff to be able to,
yeah, I mean,
you know, work out some of the kinks, you know. But I don't. I think that's one of the problems.
I think that even with existing economies, like you know, as you the listeners may know, we interviewed Steve Keen, who's one of the sharpest economists in the world right now, and he's sort of a post-Keynesian, you know, a little bit Marxian economist, and he has the best computer programs and powerful computers where he simulates economies, you know, existing economies where you actually know how they work, okay? And he puts all the data in there, and he still can only replicate certain parts of the economy. He's trying to build bigger models, but that's hard and very challenging. So if you're trying to, if you can't even build a complete model of a current economy, and you can only gain partial knowledge of that, imagine how much harder it is to have a totally abstract model where you don't know how people are going to behave. You don't have any existing data of people behaving in that manner, and then trying to see how that's going to work out for the whole system. I mean, that's a little bit crazy. So, I mean, you know, the proposals of, you know, you based on what you consumed last year, you request a certain amount of goods and stuff like that, which is basically an anti-market mechanism to allocate goods in a manner that is won't lead to you know, market outcomes. So, you know, market you know, systems. I think that is a good idea. I don't know how it would work out in reality, but you know, I basically agree with Chomsky that we should be guided by a few principles and then let the small sort of details be worked out as we go. But the first thing, of course, is struggle. And And you know, very often that's why also we support these gradual steps, you know, democratizing the state, putting forth sort of small constructive elements that help us gain more confidence in our own ability to achieve things and push forward with our demands.
Right, and I would agree with that too. I see the biggest problem with PolyCon is, you know, just implementing and see what kind of, basically trial by error, you know, what kind of flaws it has in its practice and, you know, working that out. But I think that in principle it's, you know, it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's consistent with anarchist, you know, principles. Yeah.
Right.
Did you have anything else, news or anything?
Yeah, I have
a few callers.
A few news items that I would like to touch on, and but I would also like to ask our listeners what they think about we reported yesterday that we lost Cindy Milstein at least in the immediate future as a sort of candidate to be a co-host in this program. Although she may, in fact, be doing it in the future, or at least calling in or something. But we may get somebody else, and I don't know if you guys know about her. Her name is Nuclear Knight. She has a channel on YouTube. And we were sort of debating. We think it would be cool to have her. She's got some, you know, interesting points of view, and she's a pretty sharp thinker and everything. But she's more of a Trotskyite rather than an anarchist. So we, but David, you know, Buttigieg thought that it would be a good discussion, a good sort of, you know, way of people seeing that, for people to see that there are alternative debates in the political spectrum, not only Democrat versus Republican, but maybe Trotskyite versus anarchist, you know, or, and I'm sure we coincide, we agree on many issues, but I would like people to sort of give us their opinion about what they think, you know, about this addition to our program. What's your take on that, Charchi?
I mean, I have no problem with her personally, and I do think she's a smart person, and she has a lot of you know, a lot of feminist point of view, and I'm not sure though about her.
Right. We would have to try out some of the some of the stuff here. I mean, the thing is that we really want a female voice. I mean, we're just you know, we're a bunch of guys.
It might be entertaining,
guys.
Though.
What's that?
It might be entertaining.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is that people would hear a debate as well that they don't hear, you know, in many other places, and that may be something that would attract listeners to the show. After all, a lot of people are attracted by debate and by discussion, and that could maybe enrich our show. So I say let's give her a chance, and then you know, see how she feels about it, how we feel about it, and how the listeners feel about it. And so anyway, I guess we can go on and talk about a few more news items, and unfortunately a lot of them are bad, but I'll start out with some action news here. Police in San Francisco State University sit-in, and 33 arrested. Okay, so police have arrested several San Francisco State University students who barricaded themselves inside a campus building to protest budget cuts and fee hikes, and I was talking about this yesterday. University spokesman Ellen Griffin says university and San Francisco City Police entered the business building at about 3:15 a.m. and arrested 23 people for misdemeanor trespassing. 10 protesters outside the building were arrested for misdemeanor, unlawful assembly, and resisting arrests. The students entered the building early Wednesday and blocked the doors with furniture. Most classes in the building were canceled, but Griffin says they'll resume Thursday. The school is part of the California State University system, which increased undergraduate fees this year, cut enrollment, and reduced course offerings. So that's the deal, folks. And you know what they say, that you know, that this is just they're trying out this tactic, and it's gonna spread. They're gonna try to increase fees all around the country. These bastards never get enough, and it's part of class warfare. Less education means more unskilled workers, more wage slaves to be killing each other for low wage jobs. I mean, I was just talking to a girl. I went out to get a tea with this girl, and she told me she applied to 50 jobs, you know, and just these are just low wage jobs, you know, working at the mall or something, and still hadn't gotten any answer back. I mean, it's just amazing. This is what capitalism is, folks. It's class warfare day in, day out, which is denied by the commissars, by the ideological managers, which we were talking about earlier. They deny there is class warfare. In fact, they deny there's hierarchy in our society. I mean, they deny the most basic truths of our society.
Yeah, there's not only class warfare. We've been losing for many, many decades. You know, it's hard. It's very hard. Did you see this video by The Onion? You know, like they kind of took the, you know, the unemployment like 15% or something. And they kind of switched it up, so they were saying, "Oh, it's great news for employers. You know, you have this 15% extra workforce that you could tap into." You know, it was kind of funny, but yeah, it is great for the corporations and
Right. I mean, like I
you know,
said, unemployment.
insecurity is a weapon. Insecurity is a control mechanism.
Right. I mean, you know, you can get fired easily. We can be replaced easily. Especially, see, that's the thing. Notice that not only does unemployment help the employer replace you easily, you know, like a replaceable cog, but also if you have fewer skilled workers, that is, you know, you make education more expensive, you're going to have more low-skilled workers that are very easy to replace. I mean, it's harder to replace an engineer, even though it's not impossible, but it's harder to replace an engineer than it is to replace some wage slave working at Walmart or, you know, at the mall, right? So that's what they're looking after. You have more and more low-skilled workers, and you know, that's the way it's gonna go unless we stop it. And you know, I guess I have some more bad news. I'll just report it for the sake of this. Is the demand for food aid in the United States has seen its largest increase in nearly 2 decades. In a report this week, the U.S. Conference of Mayors says cities reported an average of 26% rise in hunger assistance requests, the highest since 1991. At the same time, U.S. prison population hits all-time high. Says new figures, meanwhile, show the U.S. prison population has reacted. I'm sorry, has reached an all-time high. According to the Justice Department, 2.3 million people were behind bars last year. The prison population continues to grow at less than 1%, down from an annual 6% growth during the previous decade. I mean, that's astounding right there, and that's part of the class warfare as well. These people are superfluous people. They're put in jail and employed as wage labor, and you know, being in an American jail is no fun. You know, you may get, you know, raped, beaten. It just brutalizes people. And you know, have you ever you know, been in contact with some of these groups that monitor the you know, jails and you know, try to, you know, have correspondence with inmates and stuff.
I haven't, but I think I should. I mean, it's very important, and you know, most of the inmates are, you know, the quote unquote superfluous population, you know, black people, Hispanics, and most of them are on drug charges, you know, part of the drug war. And you know, I've heard Chomsky in the last couple of talks, you know, he talked about how, you know, the treatment of black people has been a constant slavery. And he goes through, you know, actual slavery. Then, you know, you have the few years of Reconstruction, and then, you know, the condition in the South at the time is horrible, you know. And then, you know, the economy changed so that labor was needed. But then after World War II, it was switched over again. and now it's like the drug wars. Mm-hmm. So they're basically a constant state of slavery, one form or the other, and it's really appalling, you know.
So I guess someone here on the chat room asked us, what do we think about Christopher Hitchens? Well, my opinion of Christopher Hitchens is that, you know, he's obviously a pretty, you know, a sharp thinker, and he's got a good mind, and he's articulate, but, you know, he was, talking about Trotskyites, he was a sort of Trotskyite himself, and what happened was that he, you know, he was sort of a socialist, stated socialist reactionary, although he had some good critiques of what was happening in the world. I mean, his stuff was, a lot of it was pretty good, I thought. And, but, you know, what happens with a lot of these dissidents is that they see there's not going to be a revolution, and they always change, not toward, say, anarchism or toward some other faction of dissidents, but they always tend to change toward where power is. Okay, so that's what happened to Christopher Hitchens. He said, okay, well, let me, my talent is obviously not being appreciated here as a dissident, as someone who goes against the mainstream. So he became a supporter of the Iraq War, and now he spends all his time talking about religion. Oh, you know, religion is the evil of the world, and blah, blah, blah. And of course, no more critiques of socioeconomic disparity, no more critiques of the oppressive features of our economic system, which basically are at the core of most of our problems. So he's found this other scapegoat, religion. Not to say that religion is not a cause of trouble, it often is. I'm not religious, as you probably know, but you know, I think that's what it is. He basically went where the power was, and we've seen this happening over and over again with dissidents, David Horowitz and other radicals, particularly radicals from the authoritarian left, socialist authoritarian left. What do you think about that,
maybe,
Georgie?
Maybe we'll turn too. I mean,
yeah, you never know.
That's fair enough, you know? Who knows? You know, personal commitments, if they're not strong enough, then it very well turn that way. It's hard to tell. But hopefully there's a supportive community like this. Like here, you know, we have a whole show and some loyal listeners and people we work with that keep us in line.
Right.
But
yeah,
it's hard to say.
Yeah, we're all, you know, we're all human, and we may fall prey to the, propaganda of the system, and we may just be, it may be too hard for, you know, a dissident to keep fighting against the system, and it's just easier to accept some of the premises. You'll be rewarded. You'll get some crumbs from the rich man's table, and, you know, that's some bigger crumbs. I mean, we're already getting some of the little crumbs, but you'll get bigger crumbs. And, you know, if you're hungry and you're desperate, you know, some of those bigger crumbs may look pretty damn good. Unfortunately, you sacrifice some of your integrity in the process. But anyway, so I guess we're coming to the end of the show. I want to thank listeners. I want to thank Charnchi. And I guess see you tomorrow. And don't forget, we're going to have our guest, Paul Street, a great sharp thinker. So tell your friends and come listen to the show tomorrow, The Authority Smashing Hour. Good night, folks.
Here we go. The fight all the workers who had twisted, tricked, and robbed. To the peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job. And she can't feed her family on the penny that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes. Like vegetables left in the field, the signatures smell rotten. And the contracts and the deeds that push the race down to the bottom. They load the rubber bullets, they fire another round. I'm heading to the tear gas. Dig it, man, hold your ground. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Go!
10 seconds.
Headline. Si no queremos juntos vamos a llegar.